Okay. Hello and welcome. Thank you so much for being here. I know a lot of you, and for those that I don't know, my name is Tamar Shamas, and it's nice to meet you. Anytime I ever talk about parenting, I have to start with the disclaimer that I do not give any class or share or talk about parenting because I have it figured out. Many of you are my close friends, and you can attest to the fact that I don't have it all figured out, and I am trying to figure it out like the rest of you. But I do have the opportunity to work in the field of education and also do a lot of parent classes. So that is the only reason I can talk about it. And if you see me in the grocery store and my kids are having a tantrum, then I warned you that I'm not an expert at all. But it's something that I'm always trying to learn and grow in. And so why not take time to develop a share based on something that I'm trying to get better at myself? I see some people who are, Baruch Hashem, at grandparent stage already. So they might have words of wisdom for us. And I think that what we're going to talk about today is certainly relevant for those of us who are in the current time of raising children. If we don't have them yet, then Emir Tashem, when we do have them. And I think even as grandparents, my mom always says it's like a whole new experience when you have grandkids, and you know, you're not, hopefully if you're a good grandparent, you're staying in your lane and you're not raising your grandkids, but you're certainly part of their education and growth process. So hopefully there will be something here that's meaningful for everybody. So I don't know if you've seen them, but I certainly relate to these I think they're called memes, not reels. These memes where it's like what I thought parenting was going to be like, and it's this like nice like ride along, you know, the valley, versus what parenting actually is. It's like a crazy roller coaster, you know, or something like that. We all have, you know, as young parents, these ideas of what parenting is going to be like, what type of parent we're going to be, what our kids are going to be like, and more often than not, we probably realize, just like Shira said before, that ultimately man plans and God laughs, and nothing always goes exactly according to plan. And I've been very inspired recently by the works and the ideas of Rabbi Shimon Russell. I don't know if people have heard of Rabbi Shimon Russell. He is a social worker, I believe, who specifically deals with what he calls crisis chinuch and really talks a lot about kids who have gone off the derech or are in very extreme situations. But he recently wrote a book, which I meant to bring as a visual, called Raising a Loving Family, in which he talks about crisis chinuch, but he also talks about just general parenting and raising a family. And Rabbi Russell's whole thesis, which is really nothing new but important to remember, is that ultimately we know that children are a tremendous, tremendous blessing, and they're a gift from Hashem, and that children are not only an opportunity for us to help them grow, but in the process of raising kids, we also grow ourselves as individuals. And that when we think about parenting and the parenting process, we also need to think about our own growth and how our children and their strengths and their challenges help us grow as individuals at all. And he says that when we are triggered, I won't even say if we are ever triggered by our children, but when we are triggered by our children, that actually is an opportunity for us to think about the areas in which we need to grow ourselves, and that as they're growing, we're growing and developing alongside them. So using that as our kind of basis and our thesis, I want to think about different ways that we can really help through this growth process, both for our children and for us as individuals. If you look at Source, of course, guided by Torah and Masorah, I take no credit for the title. I'm like, Emma, I'm going to talk about parenting, come up with a title. So Torah and Tantrums it is, but really parenting principles guided by Masorah is important because, of course, in every way we conduct ourselves, we want to know that it's grounded in our Masorah and in the Torah. So the Sefer HaChinuch in source number one, talking about the mitzvah of pru urvu, the mitzvah of generating and multiplying and having children, of course, explains, and I'm going to mostly stay outside of the sources, but I have them and we can read some of them inside, Mishor Shei Mitzvah Zo, that the root of this commandment of pru urvu is Kidei Sheheyeh Ha'olam Miyushav, so that the world will be settled. And Rabbi Russell takes this idea of the world being settled and talks about the idea that having kids isn't just about have a million kids, and that's the mitzvah, have as many kids as you can. It's about having kids who are settled and civilized, that Hashem wanted to create a world where people are settled, where it's not balagan, but where there is order, and it's not chaos. And that what our job as parents to do is to really make sure that our kids are living an ordered and stable life, that we should be raising kids who are healthy in mind, body, and spirit. And that really comes from the shoresh, from the root of the mitzvah given by the Sefer HaChinuch. And what's interesting is this is exactly a source that Shira brought before, that we have a mitzvah in source number 2, that when we build a roof, we need to build a fence around it so that nobody will fall. And I'm still trying to figure out what the real connection is, but Rabbeinu Bachaye in the Midrash in source number 3 explains that at the time of creation, about 4 lines down in the middle, Kikol hanivraim kulan, when all of us were created, nivru bechavtzam veratonam vehakadosh baruch hu hodiyam bereishit habria kol inyanehem kulam vekol hamakom mikraim haatidim lavol alehem. That when we were created, at the time of creation, Hashem let us know basically what our life was going to look like, about all our experiences in life. And then he talks about how long we're going to live, what our death is going to be like, if we'll enjoy an easy livelihood, what will be challenging for us. That we're told about all of this kind of before we are born, so to speak, and that we agree to us. That there is a roadmap that Hashem has created for us. Of course, we don't actually know, right, in our minds, what that is going to be, but that basically, when we're born, we agree, Hashem, strap me into the roller coaster, I'm on it, I'm willing to commit to whatever it is that you have in store for me. And that our children and raising our children is certainly part of this journey for us, that we know somewhere what's going to be, even though we don't, again, intellectually know it, and that our children give us the opportunity to help reach our shleimut, our growth and our development. And, you know, if you think about it, for those of us, and certainly those who have kids even older than me, if we think about, you know, our youngest when they were born, and the certain things we did or didn't allow with that child versus our oldest when they were born versus our youngest. I can think of an example. I remember that when my youngest was a baby, I was very hesitant to leave, and I didn't want to work too much, and I had a babysitter only a few hours a day, and we were in Berlin that year, and I remember at the end of the year, my boss at the time said, you know, you did a really good job, but it would have been helpful if you were like willing to like leave your daughter more, which at the time I was really annoyed that they said that, but whatever. But now I work full time and I have a babysitter and my youngest is with the babysitter a lot. So, you know, we grow and develop in different ways. Sometimes maybe we get a little bit lazier when our younger kids are growing up. But we change and we grow and develop, and hopefully it's for the best. We get wiser as we continue to raise our children. And Rabbi Russell has this great idea. He says that we've heard the idea of Tzar Gidul Banim, right, which comes from Chava. When Chava ate from the Eitz Hadas, Hashem told her that there would be pain in childbirth, right? And then there comes this idea given by the Gemara in Masachet Eruvin of Tzar Gidul Banim, that it's hard, that it's difficult to raise kids. Rabbi Russell suggests that we don't read it as Tzar Gidul Banim, but rather we read it as Tzar Gidul, comma, Banim, that the challenge in growing, right, is through our kids, that our kids present us with the opportunity to grow. And there's different approaches to parenting, right? There's different approaches out there, and there's certainly different approaches in the Torah. In source number 4, we have the classic example, Choshech Shuv Tosh Sone Bino V'Ohavo Sachro Musar, that he who spares the rod hates his son, and he who loves him disciplines him early, right? That it's really all about that tough love, which we know in 2023 is not necessarily the in way of parenting. If you read what's out there today, there's also a lot of differences of opinions in terms of the ages that we need to be disciplining our kids. If you look at source number 5, Masachet Du Kedushin, one says from 16 until 22, and the other one says from 18 until 24. We certainly know that we most likely start to discipline and teach our kids from a younger age now. So what do we do? What are the ways that we help develop these settled, stable, and healthy children in mind, body, and spirit while we want to grow as individuals as well? And like I said, if you Google parenting or put it into, you know, Spotify or look on the shelf at Barnes & Noble, you will see a multitude of books and podcasts and shiurim all about parenting and different approaches. And I am not here to recommend one way. I think it's important that we all find ways to parent that work both for our personalities as well as for our children's personalities, and it's not a one-size-fits-all. But what I do want to suggest, based on my professional experience that I've tried to interweave into my personal experience, as well as, of course, the Masorah, is four basic ideas that we can use to incorporate into our parenting, no matter the style. And those four tools that I want to focus on, number one, empathy. Number two, listening. Number three, helping our children feel connected. And number four, taking care of ourselves. So we're going to look at each one of those and think about how they help develop us as stronger, better parents. So the first one that I want to start with is empathy. A few years ago at Yarchei Kala, I spoke for a whole shiur on empathy. I'm going to take a few highlights of that if you remember it, which I don't expect you to. I apologize for the repeat, but I think that talking about empathy can never be spoken about enough, and it's always worth thinking about again. My favorite definition of empathy comes from Rabbi Sacks. He speaks a lot about empathy. The one quote that I like to give is this. Rabbi Sacks says that empathy is seeing the world through someone else's eyes, entering into their feelings, and acting in such a way as to let them know that they are understood, that they are heard, and that they matter. And by the way, empathy, listening, connection, taking care of ourselves, for sure when related to parenting, but I think these are tools that are important for us as individuals in any relationship that we're in our lives. So really thinking about and seeing through the experience of another. And if we think about the quintessential empathizer in the Torah, anyone want to guess who it was? Like the first role model of what it meant to be an empathizer? Abraham. That wasn't who I was going for, although certainly he had empathy that we learn when he took the malachim in and fed them and bathed them. I was actually thinking of Moshe Rabbeinu. Right? And there's for sure more than just Moshe, but Moshe kind of stands out. There's a lot of Midrashim that talk about Moshe as an empathizer. We could go through a lot, but I'll bring just one today. In source number 6, we know that Moshe Rabbeinu grew up in the house of Paro, right? And he was there when the Bnei Israel were slaves in Mitzrayim. And it says, source number 6, Vayahi bayimim ahem, vayidel Moshe. Moshe grew up. Vayetze el achav, right? He went out to the fields to his brothers. Vayar besiv lotam, and he saw their suffering. Vayar ish mitzri makhet ish ivri me'achav, and he saw an Egyptian man beating the Hebrew man, one of his brothers. And Rashi asks a question. He says, why does it say that he saw their suffering? Wasn't it obvious that when he stepped outside, he would see it? Why did it need to tell us that he saw their suffering? In source number 7, we have the Rashi who says, Natan einav velibo liyot meitzar alehem, that he directed his eyes and his heart toward them so that he would suffer along with them. He used his eyes to see what the people were experiencing, and he used his heart to feel their pain. And that's why it makes a point of saying that he saw it, because it wasn't just about seeing it, and it was about feeling it too. What we learn from here is that empathy is more than an acknowledgement of someone else's condition. I see you're having a hard day. But it's really making an emotional connection to someone else's pain, to someone else's challenge. Brené Brown, people have heard of Brené Brown, she has this great short, I think it's on YouTube, it's like a short little animated video, where she talks about the difference between sympathy and empathy. And in the video, there is like one person who's like down in a dark hole, okay? And she says that sympathy is when a friend comes and looks down in the hole and says, wow, it's really dark in there, hope you're okay, right? But keeps that distance. They see that someone else is feeling something or challenged in some way, but they keep the distance. She says that empathy is when that person on top goes down into that hole with the person who's in the dark and gives them a hug and says, I'm here for you. I'm with you right now. She says that empathy is feeling with people and sympathy is feeling for people. Empathy fuels connection and sympathy drives disconnection. And it's really important to think about the difference between those two. And of course, we see examples through Torah because we know that the ultimate example of the parent-child relationship is the example of the relationship between us and Hashem. We are children of Hashem. And we see, too, that Hashem shows empathy for us and shows that he is with us in our pain, not just looking in on what's difficult for us as a people, but actually feeling our pain with us. And one example of that is in source number 8. When Bnei Yisrael escaped Mitzrayim and they stood finally at Har Sinai ready to accept the Torah, Hashem gave them a glimpse of His throne. It says in source number 8, Vayiru et Elokei Yisrael, right, and they saw Hashem, the God, v'tachat raglav, and under His feet, so to speak, kema'aseh livnita sapir. There was this likeness of a pavement of sapphire, ke'uke'etem hashamayim latohar, like the very sky of purity. There was something, so to speak, under the feet of Hashem. And in source number 9, Rashi explains that what was this brickwork, so to speak, that was under Hashem was actually representative of the bricks of slavery. And what Rashi explains is that this was a message from Hashem to Bnei Yisrael, where Hashem said, during the time of slavery and pain and suffering, this very difficult period that you just came out of, I kept this vision of the bricks before me as a reminder of the suffering that my people are experiencing. Rather than feel for his people and watch from on high, he had this reminder so that he would feel with his people. And I think that this idea of feeling with rather than feeling for is one that's very important to keep in mind when it comes to our relationship with our children. Because I'm for sure number one guilty of it. Someone can be complaining about something. It's like, I'm so sorry, you know, here's a band-aid or here's a hug or I'm sure it's going to be okay. Right? That's kind of like sympathy or what some people call drive-by empathy. It's just this like really quick, like, I'm so sorry. You're going to be okay, you know? And taking the time to really feel with our kids. Now, I think there's a difference between feeling with our kids and getting so anxious about what they're feeling and being totally caught up in it too. And for sure, it's hard as a parent when our kids are struggling to sometimes stay in empathy zone without getting into enmeshment zone. But really letting our kids know that I'm here for you and I'm feeling this with you and I'm going to help you get through this. It's not just about looking down and saying, ooh, it's dark down there, so sorry, I'm here, but I'm in this with you. We're in this together. And I love how Stephen Covey, in his book, The Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, he has one line which I think sums it all up, and that is, seek first to understand before being understood. And so often as parents, we really want to make sure that our kids understand us and what the expectations are, which are very important, and we need to have expectations and rules. But how often do we stop to make sure that we're understanding them and their perspectives before just, you know, telling them what we want them to know about ours? So how do we become really good empathizers? Leads us to number 2, being really good listeners. In order to really empathize and to be in pain with our kids or to be in their challenges with them. And by the way, it doesn't have to be like severe, significant things, right? It's just, what are our kids feeling? What are they experiencing? What's going on in their world that we want to understand and connect to? In order to do empathy really well, we need to also work on our listening skills. And you know, when you think about it off the bat, listening doesn't seem like such a hard thing to do. But I actually learned in a course one time how hard it is. I was taking a course in being like a teacher coach. And one of the elements of coaching that you have to become really good at if you're mentoring someone else is to listen really well. And so the instructor had us simulate a listening thing. And I love to do this when I'm doing professional development, but that's not this. So I'm not going to make you do it today. But he said, everyone's going to partner up. And one person is going to be the speaker and one person is going to be the listener. And if you are the speaker, you get 2.5 minutes and you're just going to talk for 2.5 minutes without the listener doing anything. They're just going to listen. They're not going to interrupt. They're not going to ask questions. They're not going to clarify. They're just going to listen. And I remember this story because it was funny. It was an Erev Shabbos in the winter and it was one of those days where I was going to like be there until 3 and had to get home and Shabbos started at 4. And I was the speaker and my non-Jewish counterpart was the listener. And I was like, what am I going to talk about for 2.5 minutes? So I talked to her about platas and urns and making sure that my husband was setting everything up and was it all going to be ready. And I just talked for 2.5 minutes about that because it was what was on my mind on Erev Shabbos when I was going to get home 5 minutes before Shabbos. And then we switched places. And when you have to just listen, you realize how often, I should say, I realize how often when we listen, we're listening either to respond or to agree or disagree or to insert an anecdote related to what the person is saying. But real listening is not just about hearing, but it's kind of taking in what the person is saying without trying to think about what are my next words going to be? How am I going to respond? Try it. It's not as easy, unless you're really good at it already, but for me it wasn't as easy as I thought it would be to just listen, and it was a really eye-opening experience to just listen without listening for response or without listening to, give something back in return. And we learn the value of listening from Hillel. In source number 10, we learn about why it is that Beis Hillel is usually the one, when there's a machloket in the Gemara, Beis Hillel, Beis Shammai, usually Beis Hillel is the one that wins. And in source number 10 in the Gemara, it explains why it is that Beis Hillel is the one that is generally listened to. I'm not going to read it inside, you can if you want, but the Gemara sources three reasons as to why Hillel wins. Number one, is that Hillel was easygoing and patient. Number two, that he learned and tried to understand his opponent. He would really listen to Beit Shammai and fully try to understand Beit Shammai's perspective before giving his own. And number three is that he would paraphrase to make sure that he understood what his opponent was saying. And the Gemara explains that these are three very important midot for all of us to have, and these are three midot that make us really good listeners. So think about it when you think about the parent-child relationship. When you're trying to listen to your kid, they're telling you about what happened in school that day, or they're complaining about, I don't know what, fill in the blank. Are we easygoing and patient? Not always. Maybe you are. Are we learning to try to understand? Now, opponent is a severe word to use when it comes to us and our children, but I do think that often their views are opposed or different to ours, and maybe they want something, and we, like this morning in my house, could we have Dunkin' Donut for breakfast? No. But rather than say no, if I really take to heart what I'm preaching here, is trying to understand, why is it important for you to have Dunkin' Donuts this morning? Can we think of an alternative solution? Often it's just the no, we can't. So learning to understand our opponent or our child, to try to understand what it is that they want and why it's important to them, And this is going to come up in a minute, paraphrasing them to make sure that we understand what it is that they're saying. So not just hearing, but really making sure that when our children speak to us, when they have requests, when they have concerns, that we understand what it is that they are asking us for. These are all excellent qualities of good listeners, and I would say excellent qualities of good parents as well. Rav Aaron Feldman of Neri Yisrael, actually, and I don't know where I read this, brought something very interesting about the quality of the midah of being a good listener. And he says, if you think of the different sensory organs, ears are the only sensory organ that involve input but not output. And he goes through them. So he says, if you think of your mouth, right, it inputs food and it outputs speech. When you think about our nose, we input smell and we output air. When we think about our eyes, input vision, output communication. We can speak through our eyes. Hands, of course, input and output. We can take things in with our hands and we can give things with our hands. But if you think about your ears, the only thing your ears do is receive sounds. Nothing comes out, right? You just use them to receive sound. And he said that's the idea of listening. When we're really good listeners, it's not about what's coming out, about what we're giving, but it's really about fully taking in what the person that we're listening to is saying. And as I'm thinking about it, I think about also how critical it is in our spousal relationships to be good listeners, right? When someone else is speaking to us, not just to be able to say what our opinion is or what we think it should be, but to fully be able to listen. And Shira brought this up, and I think it's so true. Often, we're not even distracted by what we want to say in return, but we're distracted by our phones or we're distracted by other things that are happening. And really thinking about listening as purely input and being fully focused on listening to what the other person is saying to us is another equally important thing when it comes to our listening. So in the work that I do, when we talk about listening and when we teach parents and teachers to be better listeners, we talk about four different tools that we can use to listen and to gather information from the people that we are listening to. So number one, and let's say what you give the example of our child not being themselves, feeling down, being bothered, and then not being very forthcoming with information. Sometimes we have children who will tell us everything ad nauseum, and sometimes we have kids who are either more reluctant or shy or have a difficult time communicating to us what their concerns are. And I would say sometimes men also have a hard time communicating what their concerns are. So here are four tools. Number one is to make educated guesses, right? And of course, this looks different depending on the age of our kids. When we have little kids playing like 20 questions or hot or cold to try to get to what it is that's bothering them. If they're older, like, can I make a guess at what might be bothering you or might be getting in the way? Asking clarifying questions. So I hear you're upset about something that happened at camp today. Tell me more. Tell me more about your counselors. Tell me more about the activities that you did today. Like trying to get more information to understand their perspectives. And the last two, I think, are extremely helpful tools. Number one is reassurance. Telling our kids, this is a line that I've seen work many times, I'm sure you have a really good reason why. Right? That immediately takes off the pressure of our children to know that we're not upset, we're not judging. We fully want to understand their perspective, and I'm sure you have a really good reason why something is bothering you. I'm sure you have a really good reason why you're really upset right now. I'm sure you have a really good reason why you don't want to go to school tomorrow. Let's hear it. It doesn't mean we're giving into it, but reassuring our children that we're there and we're in it with them and we're listening to them is really important. And the final one, like I said before, is that paraphrasing or what we call reflective listening. And if you've ever been upset and someone has reflectively listened to you, which is a very strong sign of a good speaker, more likely than not, it's very calming and regulating to be reflectively listened to. And what that means is that, example with a child, they're, you know, all upset about something. And I hate my teacher and I hate school and I never want to go back. Reflective listening is saying, it sounds like you're really upset. You're really upset. And so sometimes teachers will say to me, but isn't that like parroting, or like, wouldn't that make someone annoyed if you just like try to rephrase what the other person is saying? You don't have to parrot back exactly their words, but trying to capture a person's emotions and letting know in return, it sounds like you're very excited. It sounds like you're really nervous about this, right? It sounds like you're really angry. Let's talk about it. That's reflective listening, and that's actually what we call a regulating tool. If a person, child or adult, is very dysregulated, then using reflective listening is actually a tool that helps them regulate. So reassurance and reflective listening are like two tools that I try to keep in my back pocket that are very, very helpful with both kids and adults. So we talked about empathy and we talked about reflective listening. The next thing I want to talk about is creating a sense of belonging and connection. This I first heard a few years ago, and I have found it to be so like eye-opening when it comes to thinking about human beings in general, and specifically when it comes to our kids. And this is about how do we help our kids build internal motivation. We could go on and on for another many hours about ideas of rewards and punishments and briberies and when they work and when they don't work and consequences and things like that. Putting all the external motivators aside, how do we help our kids become internally motivated people? And I don't mean internally motivated to take out the garbage and make their beds, although it would be really nice if they did that on their own without reminders or rewards. But how do we build children who are excited to get up in the morning, who are excited to go to school, who feel a sense of worth and belonging? And this comes from the theory of self-determination in psychology. There are three areas that help build internal motivation. And when I was reading Rabbi Russell's book, he has something called the three C's that are very connected. So I'm going to give you both and do with them what you want. So the first idea of the theory of self-determination, building internal motivation, is autonomy. Autonomy, which Rabbi Russell calls contributing. What this really means is making sure that our children feel a sense of independence and being able to contribute to their lives and their world in a meaningful way. So what that means as parents is how do we find opportunities to give our children choice? It doesn't mean, and teachers are like, are you telling me I should run a school where like the kids are allowed to do whatever they want all day? No, it doesn't mean that. It means how do we help build choice into a child's day? Right? So it's not like you don't have to brush your teeth if you don't want to, but you can brush your teeth before you put on your pajamas or after you put on your pajamas. That's a small choice. But other choices as well. Today's a family activity day, and today's your day to choose what we're going to do. Or we have five awesome books here. Which one do you want to read? Whatever the case may be, how can we increase our children's sense of autonomy and independence? And of course, it looks different in every age, and we have to gradually build it as our kids get older, but making sure that our children feel a sense of autonomy is really important. And I talk a lot about this with teachers of struggling students. So often when we have students who are struggling, they feel very little autonomy because there is so much restriction. There's so much you can do this, but you can't do that. And just helping build autonomy for our kids is really, really important. The second one is competence, which Rabbi Russell's C is capable. Making sure that our children know what is expected of them and how to meet expectations. Making sure that whatever it is that we expect of them, they feel a sense of, okay, I can do this. And I'll give you an example of when this didn't go well in my house. I remember my kids were little and, you know, dinner was over. And at the time, let's say one was 3 and 1 was 5. I'm like, okay, guys, time to go upstairs, get on pajamas, brush your teeth, and get in bed with a book, right? So for my 5-year-old, she was able at that point to follow multi-step directions. But my 3-year-old, at some point in the process, was just like a puddle on the floor, okay? It's a very simple example, but the point is that I didn't set an expectation that was age appropriate. He did not have the competence to be able to do what it was I was asking him to do. So making sure that our expectations as parents are aligned with where our kids are at developmentally and skill-wise, and making sure that our kids feel a sense of competence, like, I've got this, I can do this. Just this morning, my husband took my 5-year-old to learn to ride a bike, and she doesn't have the competence, and she didn't feel good about it, but it's a process. And then once she can do it, it's something that she feels better about. So helping our kids develop a sense of competence. And I always usually bring this example back to adults. I say, imagine you were going to work every day. Let's go back to the autonomy piece. Let's say you were going to work every day, and you had a boss who breathed down your back and told you exactly what you couldn't do, exactly what you could do and couldn't do, and you felt no sense of, like, where am I in this? You would feel really, most likely, really awful about getting up to go to work. And competence, let's say you went to a job where you feel like, I have no idea what I'm doing, I am faking it, and I am going to fail at this because I just don't understand whatever it is that my task is. Again, you'd feel really bad. Think about these examples related to struggling students too. The third one, and perhaps the most important one, so we have autonomy, competence. The third one is relatedness. Rabbi Russell's third C is connection. Making sure that our children feel connected to the people around them. And of course, us as parents is super important in building that relationship through the empathy, through the listening. But making sure that our kids have people in their lives that they feel connected to socially, educationally, right? Good relationships with teachers, which I know 100% of the time is not possible, but that when they go to school, they have people that they can connect to, that they have friends, and most importantly, that they feel connected to their family, to their internal family system, to their parents. Feeling a sense of connection is important too. And again, bringing it back to us as adults, imagine if you went to work where you had nobody that you connected to. Now, maybe some of us work remotely on a computer and we like that and that's fine. But my guess is that even if that is our job, we probably have people that we interface with in some way, shape, or form. And that sense of connection also internally motivates us. So the Shaarei Tshuva actually talks about this idea and making sure that our children have everything that they need. In source number 11, the Shaarei Tshuva says, "Ki mitchayav adam lirot babanim," that a person is obligated to look at their children, "ulehavin bahem," and to really truly understand them, "ulehavdil ben ikesh v'pitiltul v'en hayashar holach," to discern and discriminate between what's going on with my child and his behavior, and making sure that our children have what they need. And I would say that if something is off with our kids, if we feel like the connection is off, if we feel like the behavior is off, I always think that these three concepts are ones that are really important to go back to. Is my child feeling a sense of independence or autonomy? Is my child feeling like he or she has got this and they kind of know what's expected of them and they're able to do what's expected of them? And are they feeling connected? And this idea of connection, the Baal HaTorim brings a beautiful idea about this. Come sit down. You could tell me at the end if I did this well or not. That's my daughter. So I'm going to read this outside for the sake of time, but we know that when Yehuda goes to plead with Yosef, who he didn't realize was Yosef at the time, to bring Binyamin back home, because remember, they put the goblet in Binyamin's sack and they kind of framed him, and now Yehuda is going to beg with Yosef, please let me take my son, Binyamin, back to our father. And he says, He says in source number 12, "Ve'ata kivo el avdecha avi." If I come to my father with ve'hanar inenu itanu, and if Binyamin is not with us, ve'nafsho kshura b'nafsho. Their souls are so interconnected, right? Binyamin's soul and his father's soul are so connected. My father, it won't be okay. I need to take him back. The Baal HaTorim explains that the only other place that we see this word kshura in all of Tanakh is from a pasuk in Sefer Mishlei, which talks about ivelik kshura b'lev na'ar, that folly and foolishness, right, is kind of part and parcel to being a child. And so I'm going to read this inside because I want to give you the idea because it's written so beautifully here. The Baal HaTorim observes that the word kshura appears in only one other instance in the entire Tanakh, when Shlomo warns of youthful recklessness. Shlomo teaches us that ivelet, which is foolishness, is practically endemic to youthfulness. It's no coincidence the Baal HaTorim suggests that there is only one other relationship with the term kshura, the relationship between a parent and a child. In the Baal HaTorim words, because his foolishness is bound in him, his soul must be bound with his father's soul so that he can educate him. The Baal HaTorim here alludes to a fundamental truism about education. Youngsters, young kids, are naturally attracted to evelet, to wrong behavior and wrong decisions. And often, the most effective means of negating this force is to strengthen the bonds between them and their parents. The more that the young kids are bound to their parents with love and affection and respect, the less likely they are to be bound to evelet, to negative behavior and tendency. The Baal HaTorim here teaches and challenges us to try to strengthen the bonds with our children, even if for no other reason than to loosen the bonds that pull them in the wrong direction. So really we have the idea of here of connecting to our kids, making sure that they feel connected to us so that they feel less connected to the foolishness to which they are naturally attracted, according to the Baal HaTorim. Okay, we are running out of time, so I'm going to quickly tell you idea number 4, empathy, listening, connection. If we want to do these things well, if we want to be good listeners and empathizers and really check in with our kids and be attuned to them, we got to take care of ourselves. We have to know that we're regulated. We have to know that we have all the skills we need to be able to be really good parents. And I think that when it comes to certainly in education and also in parenting, we don't spend enough time talking about us, because we know that the minute our kid does something wrong, or at least for me, you feel like, what does this say about me as a parent? It reflects badly on me. We harbor a lot of guilt, right? The Jewish mom guilt. We harbor a lot of it. For our kids, and it's really important that we take good care of ourselves so that we can be the best parents that we can be and not always feel guilty about everything. Again, I'm not going to read them in source inside, but sources 14 and 15 talk about the importance of educating and reacting from a place of calm. And we know that that's not always easy. It's not always easy to stay calm. But there's actually been a lot of research done specifically in the world of education that shows the high correlation between a calm, centered teacher and the outcomes of students, both academically and social-emotionally. And I don't think that that's rocket science, because we can all imagine the teachers that we love the most versus the teachers who we found to be more challenging. And my guess is that the teachers that you really connected to were probably calm and kind and caring. Is that accurate? I don't want to make assumptions here. And that sometimes when we had teachers who were a little harsher or louder, sometimes it was harder to connect. That work and that research, if you're looking for books to read, is inspired by the work of Dan Siegel in The Whole Brain Child, where he talks about a child's brain and regulation. And sometimes, in order to do it well, in order to stay calm, even though inside we might be feeling a tornado and a torpedo and want to react in kind, sometimes we need to fake it till we make it. And I was actually so thrilled when I came upon a source that said, no, that's legitimate. The Torah says we have to fake it till we make it. And again, I'm not going to read it inside for the sake of timing, but the Sefer HaChinuch brings this down in source number 16. He's talking about when Bnei Yisrael were leaving Mitzrayim, they were given many laws related to the Korban Pesach, one of which was that it was forbidden to break the bones of the Korban. And a lot of different Mefarshim struggle with the meaning and the depth behind this commandment, like why couldn't they break the bones? And the Sefer HaChinuch explains that the purpose of the mitzvah, and all mitzvot in general, is to provide us with actions that inculcate character. By not breaking the bones, he says, we're demonstrating our break from slavery and our new existence of freedom. It's not proper, he says, for people of stature to break bones while eating. Therefore, when exiting servitude, when going, transitioning from being slaves to being free people, B'nai Israel are called upon to act like royalty, even when they didn't feel like royalty. This is the famous idea of the Sefer Achinuch, Achar ha-pi'ulot nimshachot ha-levavot, that after the actions, the hearts are pulled. So sometimes, he said, we're encouraged not just to fake it until we make it, but to fake it until we become it. To really try to act in a way that might be contrary to how we might be feeling in a specific moment. And ultimately, we hope that that will lead us to really be those calm and centered people, even when we're not feeling that way. The final idea that way I want to end it is a beautiful idea that I read by Chana Weisberg. She's an educator in the world of Chabad. She talks about this idea that the Aron, when they were building the Mishkan, was made of three boxes that were tucked into each other. This is in source number 17. She explains that the largest box was made from gold, the inner box was made from wood, and finally, the smallest box was made from gold as well, and that inner box is where the Aseret HaDibrut was kept. She explains that like the boxes of the Ark, we too, as individuals, are made up of layers. On the very, very inside, we are made of pure gold. We're all a godly soul made B'Tzelem Elokim and only want to do what's right and good. We always have the best of intentions, right? The next layer is our conscious self, our temperament, our moods, and our feelings. That part of us is not always so pure or shiny. And finally, there's the outer box, the part of ourselves that we allow the world to see through our actions. Sometimes we might feel hypocritical putting on a golden face to the world when inside we're feeling the opposite. How can I act outwardly kind and empathetic if inside I'm feeling woody? Should I present a facade of calmness when I really want to lash out? Why act in a way that contradicts my feelings? But the construction of the Ark, she argues, teaches us that we can improve our feelings through our actions. It's all right to have wooden moments, but outwardly act golden. Actions create internal change. Act the part and you become it. And the truth is that we aren't acting because remember what that inner box is. That inner box is gold. Our inner self is pure gold. This is true of us, and this is true of our kids. And this is really kind of what motivates all the parent classes that we do and we give. The idea is that kids do well if they can, parents do well if they can. We're all acting from a place of good. One of the more famous parenting books these days is a book by Dr. Becky Kennedy, and it's called Good Inside. It's how every kid is good inside. We're created to B'Tzelem Elokim, and so are our children. It will get messy, it will get rough, we'll be on that roller coaster, but ultimately I believe that if we work on our empathy, on our listening skills, on helping our children feel connected, and most importantly, remembering to give ourselves some grace, then Be'ezrat Hashem, those are things that will help us with God's help, because truly it's all with God's help. Those will help us raise that is what will help us raise those stable and healthy children. Thank you so much.